Pesach.
We're the bottom of Pesach. I'm an Aleph.
Oh, Pesach. That's where I am.
A very quick sugya, which we actually did already, because this sugya appears earlier in the first parak, on the discussion of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, whether or not in what position you are supposed to recite Kriya Shema, sitting versus standing, etc. So the Braisa says, Tana Rabbanan, this is six lines from the bottom, last two words, on Tazayin Amin Aleph, Tana Rabbanan b'shivtecha b'veisecha prat la'osek b'mitzvah. If one is, we Kriya Shema sitting in your house, excluding one who is engaged in doing another mitzvah, is potter from reading Kriya Shema.
V'lechtecha
v'aderech, prat l'chasan, that excludes a chasan. Mikan amru, hakones es habesula potter v'es ha'almona chay. So based upon this statement, and I would say the additional exemption, so one who is a chasan who is marrying a woman who's presumed to be a virgin is potter from reading Kriya Shema. Someone, a woman who is not an almana, he is chayav in Kriya Shema. Now, the fact that the Gemara needs to bring, or the Braisa needs to bring, two separate exclusions tells you that the chasan is not considered osek b'mitzvah, even though in some sense he is osek b'mitzvah. And the reason for that is that when we say osek b'mitzvah, potter min ha-mitzvah, that doesn't mean that if I have a mitzvah on my docket, I'm automatically exempt from doing anything else, right? All it means is that if I'm doing one mitzvah, during the time that I'm doing it, where I would be normally unable to do another mitzvah, I don't stop, or I don't have to do them at the same time. I continue doing the mitzvah that I'm doing. But if there's an opportunity to do both, if I'm not actually presently engaged in doing the mitzvah, so we don't say, osek b'mitzvah, potter min ha-mitzvah, because you're not osek b'mitzvah. So when the Braisa brings a second exemption, first, b'shiftecha b'leisecha excludes one who's osek in a mitzvah. Then, uvelechtecha v'aderech excludes a chasan, it's a different kind of exemption. It's not because the chasan is osek b'mitzvah, it's because, as the Gemara will say, and we've seen this earlier, he's tarud, he's distracted, he's very worried, he's concerned, he's anxious. So the Gemara now asks, my mashma, how is it that you see, either in b'shiftecha b'veisecha or v'lechtecha v'aderech, how do you see an exemption for mitzvah? So amar apapa ki derech, ma derech rishus, af hacha nami rishus. So just as your derech, and again, lechtecha v'aderech, just as a derech normally, and again, the Gemara is going to challenge this in a second, is considered rishus, optional. So too, anything that's optional, you have to read Kriya Shema. But if it's a mitzvah, then you don't have to. So the Gemara says, what do you mean? Milo askin da kazlo dvar mitzvah, filo hachi amarachmana, look right. Who's to say that you're actually not engaged on a derech going to do a mitzvah? You're driving somewhere to do, I don't know, pidyon shvuyim or something like that. But in the meantime, so how do you know that when the Torah says you have to read v'lechachal derech, that derech is only a derech shavashos? So the Gemara says, now, im kain lema kra beleches. Beleches baderech. Why does it say, my beleches ka, you're going, shema mina, beleches didachu de mechaibis ha de mitzvah patiras. That only when you're going for yourself, not for a mitzvah, so then you're chayiv in kriya shema. But if you're not going belechtecha, you're going for somebody else, So then you're going for, or you could somebody else, you're doing for a mitzvah, so then you would be exempt from reading. So now the Gemara says on the top of Kazayin of a days, I hachi, my irya hakones es habsula, afilu kones es ha'amana. So why then is there a distinction? If you're engaged in going to do a mitzvah, why is it that it's limited to kones es habsula, not kones es ha'amana? So the Gemara says, "Hacha tarid v'hacha lo tarid." In one case, he's very concerned. He's concerned maybe he's going to discover she's not a virgin, she's not a psula. It's going to create all sorts of issues. Whatever the reason, he's very nervous there. By Elamana, he's not nervous, and therefore, when he's tarid, he's exempt from reading Kriya Shema. When he is not tarid, so he has to read Kriya Shema. So then the Gemara says,
Rabbi Leader.
Yes.
Why are you assuming that his taridness is about things relating to her status as opposed to, for example, performance anxiety or just fear of being married. I'm wondering why you're putting it on a potential imperfection in the woman.
So because the Gemara doesn't distinguish between a bachor and an almon, which would be the terms for him. It's for distinguishing between konesis almana and konesis absula. That's number one. And number two, I think that if you study Maseches Ksubos, the first parak, you realize that this was kind of a big deal. And in fact, so much so, I think most of us would find this very strange, to put it mildly. But the Rama and Shulchan Aruch, this is not I'm pretty sure this is not the practice. And I'm pretty sure they don't teach this in chassan classes. But there is a bracha that is made when a husband is boel, consummates the marriage and discovers that the fact there is blood. There is a bracha. You look in Shulchan Aruch. It's an Evan Ezra. The Rama quotes it. I think it's an Evan Ezra, unless it's in Yeridayim. I think it's Evan Ezra. We don't do this, but because for us this seems a little bit. Again, we live in a really different world than even of 100 years ago, and certainly than the time than 500 years ago, and so on. So for us, I don't think it's quite as big a deal. But for them, it was a really big deal. But even without that, even without reference to the Gemara Ksubos, the terminology itself, Kones is Absula versus Kones Salmana, as opposed to a Bachor and an Alman. Okay. So now the Gemara says, one second, Imishum Tirda, if the issue is that he's distracted, it's not that he's right now. Now, see that right? In other words, the Mishnah, in fact, had said, I think our Mishnah said, our Mishnah actually didn't say it, but we assume that the exemption only lasts four nights. It only lasts four nights. If he hasn't consummated the marriage by then, the assumption is, even though he has this kind of background anxiety, that it's not a forever exemption. But the bottom line is, it's not that he's exempt because he's doing a mitzvah right now. He's exempt because he's worried. So the Gemara says, Imishum Tirda, filu tavas svinasa vayam nami. You know, the modern equivalent, if he's watching the stock market and the Dow is starting to crash, you know, hundreds and hundreds of points, and now it's Mount Kriyashma comes, so you would say that this is like tavas svinasa vayam. His boat, all his merchandise is going down in the sea. So he's totally anxious, panic, can't focus. So imishum tirda filu tavas svinasa vayam nami. But if that's the case, now maybe you would say yes. So the Gemara says, Alama Amar Rabbi Abba Barzavda Amarav, Ovil Chaye B'chol Mitzvos Ha'amuros Batorah, Chutz Min HaTfilin. And Ovil, not an Onay, not a person where the mace has not been buried yet, but once the mace has been buried, and Ovil is obligated to perform all mitzvos, except for a male Ovil fulfilling the mitzvah of Tfilin. Shaharei Nemar Bohen Pe'er. Because with respect to tefillin, they are described as pe'er, some type of a glorious garment. Shenemar pe'ercha chavosh alecha. Yechezkel Hanavi in chapter 24 is told that his wife is going to die, and he's told to engage in a series of behaviors, all of which are understood to be references to practices of mourning, some of which he was told to do, and some of which he was told to not do, even though a mourner would normally engage in that practice. The reason for this prophecy is that he was to serve, his message to the people was that there are so many people who are going to die during the destruction that people are not going to be able to mourn normally. So anything Yechezkel was told to do, Chazal make an inference of one way or the other, whether or not what the prohibited practices of Avelis were. In other words, if he's told to do something unusual that normally you wouldn't do, that's obviously something that an Avel does, and Yechezkel was being told to do that. If he's told to do something which is normally done by a regular person, then the assumption must be is that an Avel wouldn't do it, but Yechezkel's being told in this fashion that he's supposed to behave in a normal way. So, for example, if you look in the pasuk, he's told, "Hey, anel dom, meisim eva lo sase." So he is supposed to be silent. Apparently, that's something that an avel does do. An avel doesn't agree. He doesn't give shela shalom. But he's also not supposed to engage in normal mourning. So Pe'er Chachavo Shalecha, your Pe'er, you should put upon yourself. And the word chavosh, let's say in recent parashios, refers to the v'chavashta lahem migbaos, you put something on the head. So Chazal understand the pe'er is the tefillin. So Yecheskel is told to wear tefillin. He's told unalecha tasim barazlecha, and you're also supposed to put your shoes on your feet, which means that avel doesn't wear shoes. And then he's told v'lo sa'ate al safam. Not clear what Oteh al-Safam means, but we saw it actually in last week's Parsha by a Metzorah. A Metzorah is the al-Safam Ya'ateh, something about covering his face. So he's told not to cover his face, even though an Avil would normally do that. And he's also told to Lechem Anashim Lo Sochel, you shouldn't eat the bread of other people, which Chazal understand is a reference to the Sudas Havra, the first Suda that an Avil eats on the day of the burial. The eating of that day has to not come from their own, it has to be provided by others, by the community, by other people. So Yecheskel is told, Pe'ercha chavosh alecha, but normally an Avel is not allowed to wear tefillin because somehow, I think Rashi says, not here, elsewhere, an Avel is supposed to be almost rolling in the afar, and it's inappropriate then that he should have tefillin on. So there's a machlokas, how long you don't wear tefillin, our practices, an Avel doesn't wear tefillin just the first day. But the bottom line, the Gemara says, is that all the other mitzvahs an Avel has to do, and an Avel is going to be tarud. An Avel is going to be distracted and anxious and sort of unable to concentrate because of his loss. So why is an Avel chayiv in Kriyat Shema? You said an Avel is only exempt from one mitzvah, tefillin. So the Gemara answers, Amrei hasam tirda de rishus, kocha tirda de mitzvah. When it comes to Avelus, the tirda is one of rishus. It's not a mitzvah. Whereas when it comes to the tirda of a chassan, it's about of a mitzvah that he's about to do. This is a very interesting statement about avelus and the nature of avelus. The way I think Torah generally works with the principle, the Balei Musar, particularly the Sefer Achinuch, emphasizes this point that halavavos nimshachos achar hapu'ulos. There's a whole field of psychology that's dedicated to this. The idea that we don't try to dictate emotions or dictate what's inside a person's mind as much as we dictate what kinds of behaviors a person engages in, and the behaviors that a person engages in end up shaping his or her personality. And therefore, when it comes to avelus, there's no mitzvah per se of being sad or of crying. But Hilchos Avelus is a series of practices which are designed, in effect, to foster these type of emotions. And if they do, that's great. And if they don't, well, that's the halacha doesn't say you're going to have to feel in this particular way. And therefore, when I think Rashi may say this earlier in the Masechta, when the Gemara says tirda the rishus, of course an avel may be tarud and part of the avelus, but there's no mitzvah him to be tarud. And therefore, Chazal didn't see fit to exempt him from the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. Okay.
Rabbi Leader?
Yes.
Is there a mitzvah for the chassan to be tarud about the status of his bride?
Is there a mitzvah? But he's tarud for a mitzvah that he's about to do.
No, but we said the tarud, the tirda was because he's afraid he will find her, he won't find her a virgin.
I understand, but his tirda is over the concern of his performing Bia Rishona and what he's going to find. Whereas the Avel, there's no tirda in preparation for a mitzvah.
I thought you said that Marshall said that it was performance anxiety, you said that it's being concerned about the status of his bride. That you said they made a bracha.
But the only way he gets there is by performing the mitzvah via Rishona. There is a mitzvah between him that he is anxious. I don't think it's performance anxiety in the contemporary usage of the term. It might have created, you would say, performance anxiety because he has a mitzvah to do and he's worried about doing that mitzvah. And worried about what he's going to find. That at least I think is what makes him so concerned. If he weren't concerned over what he was going to find upon doing the mitzvah, we wouldn't distinguish between Amana and Besula. It would be one way or the other. But the Avel, there's no mitzvah that the Avel is going to do. any pirda he experiences is just, it might be a byproduct of the laws of Avelus, it might be a byproduct of his natural emotions, but there's no mitzvah that he's anxious about having to go perform. Okay.
In the end, why would mitzvah even be important? In the end, it's really the person's state of mind.
Sam, that's a broader question. And I think that if you look in Shulchan Aruch, you'll see that a person who really can't concentrate, in other words, if a person watched the stock market crash and they're catatonic and they literally can't move, they might be potter from Kriya Shema, right? If they're incapable of producing kavana, but it's not a blanket exemption that on a day that the market crashes, everybody's exempt from Kriya Shema. Right? Sometimes Chazal were mishair. They made an estimation that most normal people under these circumstances, we don't expect them to be concentrated because they're engaged in a tirda de mitzvah. And therefore, we are going to declare an exemption for this type of person in this type of situation. A person who is unable to concentrate at all because they are tarud, is the mainless potter. That's not different. I mean, it's not the exact same thing, but it's like mitzvah potter menasukah, right? In other words, we say that when there's a certain amount of rain, we provide sort of an objective criteria that at that point you can know you're exempt from eating the sukkah, you're not supposed to eat in the sukkah. But there is a category of mitzvah that goes beyond, in other words, for most of us, if there's a drop here and a drop there, that's not an exemption from sitting in the sukkah. But there might be people who are so, what we'd say, coming into the next Mishnah, so istinous, so delicate, that even a drop or two of rain makes them so anxious and so on shvilkas that they're potter from the sukkah because they're mitzvah. But there's no blanket, that's subjective, that depends upon the individual. Whereas the idea that when the rain, a certain amount of rain, where it's falling into the mikvah, falling into your soup and a certain effect, that's an objective criteria that Chazal provided, that's when you leave the sukkah. So the same thing is true here. A person who is so tired and can't concentrate, can't do the mitzvah. We might say he's anus, he's potter from Kriya Shema. But the idea that a chasan is potter from Kriya Shema, as long as he wasn't boel b'yom rishona, is a blanket exemption offered by Chazal judging the situation for the overwhelming majority of people. What happened in our Mishnah was Rabban Gamliel said, I'm going to read because I can concentrate. Okay, but nonetheless, that was an individual's action.
Rabbi, the strange thing is that they used Tavas Finato Bayam then. Because in the Maskana of the Gemara, it's implying that Tavas Finaso Bayam is Chayav in
right.
Kriya Shema because it's a Tir de Rishus.
Right.
And yet that would seem to be in the category of Nitzayer, I would think.
I think you might even argue, David, that Chazal here are sending a message to us. In both of these cases, actually. Each in their own way. In the case of the Tavas Finaso Bayam, maybe, yes, I understand most of us would be probably over anxious, but maybe there are supposed to be important things that we really should be so anxious over and certain things that we really shouldn't be so anxious over because they really shouldn't be so important. And in the case of Avelos, I think it's actually very telling. There's a Gemara in Pesachim that talks about certain things that had to be that way, that were created, and seven gzeros. And one of them is al hamesh shetishtakach min halev, that the mace should be forgotten by people. One thing the Brisa says is the mace that the body will decompose, because the body decomposed. The Rashi says people would just keep the body of their relative there, and they would constantly be reminded of the pain. So when we have someone who's an onain, which we'll talk about in the next Mishnah, who hasn't buried the mace yet, there's an expectation that there's no expectation that it's time to move on. Whereas once you bury the mace and you begin Avelus, so the assumption is that it is time to move on. Obviously, different situations take tip and different people can take longer or shorter. But if you really are so fatumult that you can't concentrate, you'll be potter. But the message of the halach, I think, is that now it's time to move on. Now, yes, there's it's time to mourn. Mourning doesn't mean totally being removed from the world. That might be aninus. Aninus, you're exempt from all mitzvahs. Avelus, it's time to start the process of moving on. Okay. All right. So now the Mishnah continues and says, "Rochatz Laila Harishon Shemesa Ishto." So the first night that Rabban Gamliel's wife died. I mean, I don't know. I always kind of wondered: what was the order of these events? Is the previous Mishnah when they first got married, and this is when she died? Or is this happened first? She died, and that's why Rabban Gamliel took another wife. I ask that question only half tongue-in-cheek, because it's odd to me that Rabban Gamliel should have gotten married so late that he has Talmidim telling him, you know, what to do. He certainly didn't lack for Parnassa as the Nasi. And one would have imagined with the emphasis, you know, Chazal placed on getting married early, Rabban Gamliel would have had no shortage of opportunities to get married early. And the idea that he's getting married, reads Kriya Shema, and his Talmidim are saying, Haloli Matanu Rabbeinu, doesn't sound like he was 20 years old. Right? It sounded like he was much older, which makes me wonder whether that Mishnah was actually, you know, chronologically before this Mishnah. This is Mesa Ishto, and that's when he remarries.
But there were three Rab Gamliels. Maybe it's one of the other Rab Gamliels.
So that given the sequence, there are two Rab Gamliels, that's true. Given the sequence, it's unlikely that it's jumping back and forth. Firstly, the real answer is probably that whenever it's his grandfather, I'll give you the lineup in a second. Whenever it's his grandfather, he'll be referred to as Rabban Gamliel HaZake. You have in the first Mishnayos, in the fourth Perek in Gittin, you have a sequence of things, a number of which Rabban Gamliel HaZakein was Mesakein, Nei Tikkun HaOlam, and those things, I think, are labeled Rabban Gamliel HaZakein. I hope I'm not wrong on that. But I would expect that the sequence, when you have a series of Mishnayos, and these are a series of things, so at least three things that he does that he didn't teach his students, and they all say, but Haloli Madtan Rabbeinu, didn't you teach us otherwise? I assume it's the same person. It's also more likely to be Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. Just as to remember the sequence of Nisim, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which we learned a long time ago, and in Shabbos also says that Hillel, v'Shimon b'no, v'Gamliel b'no, v'Shimon b'no, na'agu nisiyosam me'ashana kodam abayis. Hillel began his nisiyos, his reign as the president or the governor, whatever that position is, 100 years, and he had a son Shimon, who had a son Gamliel, who had a son Shimon. That second Shimon was the first Rabban Shimon Gamliel. He was the Nasi at the time of the destruction. Josephus actually refers to him by name. Josephus didn't like him. I imagine he probably didn't like Josephus either. But he wasn't the one writing the history books in the same way, so Josephus got that word in. And then Shimon ben Gamliel, the Nasi at the time of the Churban, his son was Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. Their reigns were interrupted only by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who temporarily held the Nisios in between right after the Churban. Then that Gamliel, Gamliel Asheni, the Gamliel of Yavne, the one who we'll learn later in the Masechta, got into fights with Rabbi Yoshua and almost got dethroned. So he had a son, Shimon. That's the regular Rabban Shimon Gamliel. He was Shimon Gamliel Asheni, who was Rabbi Yehuda Anasi's father. And Rabbi Yehuda Anasi had two sons whom he named, I believe, Shimon and Gamliel. Okay, so anyway, So I assume, Isaac, that this is probably, whichever Rabban Gamliel it is, I assume it's the same, and it's probably Rabban Gamliel Hasheni, Rabban Gamliel of Yafne. Okay, so just a piece of, so the first night that after his wife died, and presumably they buried her that day, so he washed, he bathed or in some kind. So Amr lo Talmidav, his student said to him, Limad Tana Rabbeinu, didn't you teach us, Rabbi? Sha'avel asr lirchot, and avel is not allowed to bathe. Amar Lahem, he said to them, Eini kishar b'nei adam, istinasani. I'm very delicate, maybe he had skin issues or something like that, and therefore I need to bathe. I'm not included in that prohibition. Now, what our Gemara is not going to say, but the Yerushalmi does say, and this is assumed to be lahalacha, is that the only type of washing or bathing that is prohibited for an avel, and the same thing is true on Yom Kippur, is rechitza shel tanur. It's explicitly formulated by the Yerushalmi that way. Tosus quotes it here. It has to be bathing really for the pleasure of bathing. If it's bathing because the Yushami says, Mishesh lo chatatim barosha, he has some type of acne or something like that where it's unpleasant and painful for him, he is permitted to wash those things on Yom Kippur. It's why we wash our hands after using the bathroom on Yom Kippur, because it's not because of sakana. I mean, it's not likely to be necessarily sakana, but it's because its purpose is for hygiene, not for pleasure, right? We don't use hot water because there's no need to use hot water. And if there were a particular need to use hot water, then it might be permitted, you know, if it's not rechitza shel tanur. But anyway, so that's what he did. He was an istinus, and therefore rechitza was permissible for him. Okay. Now, to sort of just a little bit of background, we're going to get to the Gemara shortly to deal with this issue, but just a little bit of a backdrop. There are two categories within the laws of mourning of status of a person. The first one, as I referred to before, is aninus, and the second one is avelus. In onein in halacha, the way we know it, which is not actually 100% true la halacha, but the way we encounter an onein is that when a person loses a relative for whom they mourn, from the time of, assuming that there's not going to be an extended period in between, in Europe you had these situations where the government would demand a very long waiting period, or you had situations where a person's body was, it was in captivity and the government wasn't releasing it, like the Marami Rutenberg, and I'm sure many other cases. But in a normal case, where the expectation is within a couple of days there's going to be a burial, from the time of the passing until the time of the burial, we say that a person has the status of being an onein, or woman we call, I guess, an onenes. You have the period of what's known as aninus. Once the body is buried, or once they send the body off to Israel, you turn around, you're going home. At that point, when all your responsibility and connection to the burial is over, again, because either because the burial's happened or because you're done with it, then you begin the period of avelus. In our halachic world, aninus basically means that you don't perform positive mitzvos, you don't perform mitzvos asei, you don't say brachos when you eat, before or after, you don't say kriyashma, you don't daven, a man doesn't put on tefillin, you don't count sfiras haomer. Don't ask me what you do to fix that problem. There's a fix to that problem. You're going to miss more than a day. All those things you don't do. And an onein is not allowed. The only thing that I think everybody agrees to, an onein cannot eat meat or drink wine. And an onein is not allowed to engage in sexual relations. Those are the only things that, those three things outside of mitzvos are the only things that everybody agrees an onein is prohibited. Some say that an onein can't do some of the practices of avelus as well. Some Rishonim say, I think the Ramban says, that any practices of avelus that don't interfere with the burial are also prohibited to an onein. Some Rishonim say no, it's only what the Gemara specifies, which is meat and wine, which by the way, an avel can partake in, and tashmish, hamita, sexual relations, which an avel also can't partake in. So for us, there's a period of aninus, and we say it goes up until the burial or when you're done with the burial, and then the avelus begins normally, if there are no interruptions of Yom Tov, for 7 days. That's the way we understand it. Min HaTorah, Midoraisa, the story is somewhat different. Aninus, according to Torah law, has no impact upon most of the things that we know of in terms of aninus and avelus. And I should preface it by saying, all Rishonim agree that aninus, the period of aninus, is deoraisa in some way. It has a deoraisa status. Where does it matter for Torah law? It matters primarily in two areas. Number one, a kohen who is an onein, a kohen head yot, may not do avoda or eat kodshim. And a kohen gadol, we're going to read about in this week's parsha, a kohen gadol can do avoda, but he can't eat kachim either. Okay, so no Kohen can eat kachim. Nobody who's an onein, even a Yisrael who has, you know, a kachim kalim, you may not eat kachim at all. A Kohen hedyot can't do avoda. And an onein cannot eat maser sheni. Cannot eat maser sheni. He can't eat maser sheni because part of the vidui maestros that we read in Parshas Kisavo is he says, look, what a person says, I've done everything properly. Lo achalti ve'oni mimenu. I didn't eat from Maser Sheni when I was an onein. A Kohen, by the way, is allowed to eat Truma when he or she or Bas Kohen if she is an onein at the time. Bikurim is a machlokes. But basically, that's the only area. It's stuff that's related to Kodesh, of eating, consumption of Kodesh, is the only thing that was clearly Midda Oraisa when it comes to the period of Aninus. What is the stat now? There is one big machlokes that the Gemara is going to raise. When is a person considered an onein? So it would appear that for being an onein for those purposes, you're an onein when the mace dies, until the mace is buried, and the rest of that day, and then the night that follows the day that you buried the mace is also, there is aninus, except for it's a machlokas, whether aninus laila is mid the oraisa or mid the rabbanon. It would seem that we pass in it's mid the rabbanon, but that is a machlokas. So the way aninus works in Torah law is very much not the way it works for us. For us, as soon as you bury the mace, done. It's over. Now you start avelos. Aninus de oraisa is certainly finishes the entire day of when the mace was buried, and maybe even the night that follows, which is not, by the way, so strange if you think about it, because even though we normally assume that night comes before day in halacha, there is only one area in halacha where day comes before night, almost ubiquitously in that area of halacha, and that's kachim. You bring a karban, you eat it the day you shecht it, and the night that follows. That's kind of the standard thing when it comes to kachim, that the day comes before the night. And since aninus is almost focused mid the oraisa, totally around things that are kachim, master sheni is not technically kachim, it shouldn't be a surprise that there are those who would think that mid the oraisa, even the night that follows, has the status of aninus. But that's, we don't eat kachim, we don't eat master sheni today. So when we think about aninus, we're thinking about a series of rabbinic prohibitions, and they stop at the time that you bury the body. The next question that comes along with this, and the Gemara is not really going to explore this, but the Rishonim do here. There's a very long passage in the Rush and a very long passage in the Ram. We're not going to read it. I don't know if I've ever sort of mentioned this in passing before. There is a big machlokas for Rishonim between, on the one side, the Gaonim and the Sfardi Rishonim, Chachmei Sfarad, and then the Ashkenazi Rishonim on the other side. Is Avelus ever the Oraisa? Is there ever a situation in where the observances of Avelos are mid Oraisa? Chachmei Svarad and the Gaonim say that if a person dies on a given day and the person is buried that day, the Avelos of the first day is mid Oraisa. It is mid Oraisa. They're probably not going to say the night that follows is the Oraisa, because the Gemara, we paskin aninos laila is the Rabbanan. So any of our velos will also only be the Rabbanan at night. But again, Chachmei Sfarad and the Gaonim say that aninos, avelos yom rishon, when the yom ha-misa and the yom ha-kivura, the day of the death and the day of the burial are the same, that avelos is mida Oraisa. Chachmei Ashkenaz say, nothing doing. All Avelus is the Rabbanon. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are. Now you'll ask me, okay, that's very nice, but we observe Avelus anyway. Is there any particular nafkamina? You could always, of course, always say that we have a rule that a suffik, a doubtful case in the Doraisas, the Chumra, a doubtful case in the Rabbanon, the Kula. Okay, the question is, in a real pragmatic sense, is there ever a situation where is there a nafkamina between the two? And the answer is yes. There's one case where there's a nafkamina, whether or not you believe Avelus Yom Rishon is Doraisa or not. And that is the following. If a mace dies on the last day of Yom Tov in Chutz La'aretz, on Yom Tov Sheni, but the last Yom Tov Sheni, meaning Simchat Torah, eighth day of Pesach, or second day of Shavuos. If a mace dies on the last day of Yom Tov, so the practice according to the Gemara, and still practiced in very few Jewish communities, is to bury a mace on Yom Tov Sheni, even Al Yedei Yisrael. You bury the body on Yom Tov Sheni. Okay, so now the question is, when do you start Avelus? So, it says in the Shulchan Aruch, and Rishonim say this, if Avelus Yom Rishon is the Oraisa, if you bury the mace on the last day of Yom Tov in Chutz La'aretz, you start Avelus on Yom Tov. Avelus is Docha Yom Tov, because Yom Tov Sheni is only Midrabanon, whereas Avelus Yom Rishon is Doraisa. If, however, you believe that Avelus of the first day is always the Rabbanon, as Chachmei Ashkenaz do, then even if you bury the mace on the last day of Yom Tov in Chutz La'aretz, still Yom Tov Sheni, the Rabbanon, pushes aside Avelus Yom Rishon, which is only the Rabbanon. In one of what I like to think of the Ramah's very clever digs at the Mechaber, and Ramah is usually pretty respectful, but the Mechaber in Shulchan Aruch presents both opinions, acknowledges the nafkamina between the two, namely whether you start Avelus on a mace who's died and buried on the last day of Yom Tov, and then the Mechaber says, and a practice apparently is not to start Avelus on the last day of Yom Tov, even though the mace was died and buried on that day. And the Ramah just comes along and just says yes, because Yom Tov Avelus Yom Rishon is only the Rabbanon. Okay, here the Ashkenazim one. Even the Sephardim will have to admit that we won on this particular one. But anyway, that's a major, major machlokas. There are a lot of Gemaras that are brought. If you're interested, you can go look at either the Rush here, it's right at the end of the Perek, or the Ran on the Rif, and they go back and forth with what the various proofs were in one direction or the other. But the assumption, certainly in our practice, the place where it actually matters, which is the keeping up, starting Avelus on the last day, when the mace is died and buried on the last day of Yom Tov, in Chutz Laaretz, our practice is we do not begin Avelus then. We don't encounter this very much because very few communities anyway bury on Yom Tov Sheni, so it's kind of irrelevant. But if you lived in a community, I think Satmar buries on Yom Tov Sheni. I don't know if the Yekis still do. I think they used to. So if they bury on Yom Tov Sheni and you had a situation, again, remember, it has to be that the person dies on Yom Tov Sheni. If the person died on Shvi Shel Pesach or on the last day of Chol HaMoed and weren't able to bury the mace, under those circumstances, even if you did bury the mace on Yom Tov Sheni, nonetheless, the Yom HaMisa and the Yom HaKavura, the day of the death and the day of the burial, would not be one and the same, and therefore everybody agrees that the Avelus of the first day in that case is only Drabanan, in which case there would be no question whatsoever you wouldn't start Avelus on Yom Tov. Do note, however, that when we count the days of Avelus, we count Yom Tov Sheni. In other words, if you bury a mace during Chol HaMoed, you don't start Shiva till afterwards, but the first day of the Shiva, even though you don't observe the practices of Shiva, at least nothing that's even remotely public, is the last day of the Yom Tov Sheni. Okay.
That's just, if I can.
Sure, please.
In terms of the practice of not burying the Yom Tov Sheni, I think the reason for the development of that practice is because in the natural course of things, if you buried somebody, if you buried the mace on the second day of Yom Tov, then more people who would not be necessary for the actual burial would go out to the cemetery, and that would be a chilul Yom Tov. In other words, you're really only allowed basically for the Chevra Kadisha that has to be involved in the transportation and the burial and everything. You can't have cousins and aunts and uncles driving to the cemetery on a second day Yom Tov. In all of my experience, it only happened once. I remember exactly who it was, but it's not necessary to mention their names here. Very pious man, died on Achron Shel Pesach early in the morning and was buried that day. Only his son and a couple of people who were necessary for the burial went actually out to the cemetery. But in practice, if you really had a burial on second day Yom Tov, many people who are not allowed to go would be going, and so therefore you'd have a real chilul Yom Tov.
So that is 100% correct. The Gemara talks about, I think they sent, I forget who they sent the Shilas to, B'nai Bishkar Levi. It's a Gemara in Shabbos. I think it's in the 20th or 21st Perek. And they asked for any kulas about a mace, and they said that you couldn't bury the mace even on Yom Tov Sheni. And the Gemara asked, but we could bury a mace on Yom Tov Sheni. You know, Ide Yisrael, and the Gemara says, you know, B'nai Bishkar Levi are not B'nai Torah. So therefore, they're going to do exactly that. People whose services are not necessary for burying the mace are going to be Michal Yom Tov. I believe there's a discussion amongst the Balei HaTosfos where Rabbeinu Tam utters a famous line. There were those who pushed that you should bury me on Yom Sheni, and Rabbeinu Tam said, B'nai Bishkar Levi ain't B'nai Torah, anu B'nai Torah? If they weren't, there's an assumption that all Jews who lived in the time of the Gemara were such strict tzaddikim. That was probably not true. Rabbeinu Tam was opposed probably for the same reason, and that was rhetorical, but he said the same thing. I suspect that there's another reason that today, even communities that might have buried 100 years ago won't do it anymore, which is the advent of refrigeration. The only reason why Chazal permitted burying on Yom Tov Rishon through Goyim. A Jew can't do Malacha, but Goyim can, you can have a Amir La'achim if you want to bury mace on Yom Tov Rishon. They didn't allow it on Shabbos or Yom Kippur, but on Yom Tov Rishon and on Yom Tov Sheni Yadei Yisrael. The reason they did that is because of Bizayon HaMeis, the concern that the body would decompose, it would be a Nivul HaMeis. It's the same reason why they rigged the calendar so Yom Kippur should never come out on Friday or Sunday. Because since you cannot bury on Shabbos or Yom Kippur, even al yidei akum. They didn't want a situation where a mace died right before and the mace had to sit over out for 48 hours being unable to bury the mace. So for us, it's less of a consideration only because there's, if they put the mace in the refrigerator in the morgue, so then the body's not going to decompose the same way. So it's not a nivel ha-mace in the same way. So I think that's an additional reason today. But Rabbi Lichtenstein said is what the Gemara and the Rishonim say, you know, that strongly, the Gemara didn't say it was also. The Gemara just said in one case, a group of people were told no, and Rabbi Nutam objected to the practice as well. I don't know if that Sephardi Rishonim followed Rabbi Nutam's position, but today I suspect very few would bury because one of the major impetuses to burying on Yom Tov doesn't exist anymore. Again, we still emphasize the importance of burying quickly, but nonetheless, it's less of a concern. It's not just that we are violating Lo Sullin, but it would have been a Nivel Hamais, which isn't as much so today. Isaac, you had a question.
Yeah, no, just a point. We had a situation right in the community here. Somebody's mother died the last day of Pesach a month ago or whatever. And they weren't sure what to do. And somebody referred him to me. And he was Fardik. He belonged to the Great Neck community. And I pulled out the second volume of Avadya Yosef, had the T volume on Hilchos Aveilus. And he says that absolutely you should not bury on the second day Yom Tov. And he said, especially if it's your mother or a father, and he quoted the Gemara Moed Katan Megunahulo, it's an insult to rush the burial of a, but nevertheless, this person insisted. So one member of the Chevra Kedisha and the non-Jewish ambulance driver or hers driver went. And this happened just a month ago. And when I spoke to him after Yom Tov, he told me he spoke to his rabbi in Great Neck and the Sephardic community, and he told him he did the right thing.
Again, technically speaking, you know, I understand that, you know, the Gemara that Chacham Ovadia was quoting is not in reference to this. It's in reference to whether you rush the burial, burial in general. But I understand. But again, I think that part of what mitigates the interest is A, what Rabbi Lichtenstein referred to, but B, also for us especially, you leave the mace in refrigeration so the body's not going to decompose. Okay.
Rabbi. Yeah. Rabbi. On Linus Avelus, am I correct in saying that the avoidance of meat and wine does not apply on Shabbat?
Correct. It does not apply on Shabbos. There's a machlokas in the Gemara. We're going to see this, by the way, God willing, in a few weeks. The beginning of the third parak, we're going to get more than our dose of literally, if you turn the page, you will see Misha Meso Mutal Lefanav, the first Mishnah of the third parak. And most of the Gemaras of Aninus are, if you turn the page, are on Yurches Amid Aleph. There's a machlokas HaTanoim there, whether or not Hashmish Hamitza, the mitzvah of Ona, is permissible on Shabbos. But that's the Dover Shabbatina. I don't think anybody argues on the meat and wine. The meat and wine, I believe, you can eat on Shabbos. Also, I should really go a step further. There really isn't, Aninus may not apply this, well, let's put it this way. Mitzvos you do on Shabbos. Because the only reason you're exempt from mitzvos is because you're sensibly engaged in taking care of preparations for the funeral, because you can't do that on Shabbos. You do all mitzvahs. Unless the only time you wouldn't would be, let's say it's half an hour before Shabbos is over, and you're going to walk to the edge of the tchum, where let's say the funeral home is just beyond the tchum, you're going to be, it's called machshich al tchum, to make preparations. So during that time, you can't chas v'shalom be mechal Shabbos, but you'd be exempt from mitzvah sasei when you're machshich al tchum. But outside of that on Shabbos, with the exception of Tasha Shamita, a person is not an owning. Okay. So now the Mishnah continues and says a third story. Ukshames Tevi Avdo, when his Eved, his servant Tevi, who's very famous, he was a Talmud Chacham. He was an Eved Kanani, technically, so he's 98% Jewish. If he had been freed, he would have been fully Jewish. He would have been what we call an Eved Meshuchra. So Ukshames Tevi Avdo. So Kibel Alav Tanchumim, when they buried him, so they, it sounds like he sat Shiva of some kind. So Omer Lo Tamidav, his student said to him, Limantan Rabbeinu She'e Mekablin Tanchumim Ala Avadim. We don't accept Tanchumim Ala Avadim. So Omer Lo, now why? There may be differences of opinion on this particular question. Some Rishonim say, the Gemara doesn't state explicitly why. Some Rishonim state that it's a concern over Yuchsin, that if you're Mekabel Tanchumin on the Eved, they'll think that he's a fully, full-fledged Ben Chorin or Bas Chorin. And then people will assume that his children or her children are fully Jewish and can marry, you know, members of the Jewish community. That seems to be the, at least that's what a number of Rishonim comment in certain points of the Gemara. We'll talk about it more that when we get there. But they said you don't normally do that. So Amar Lahem, Ein Tevi Avdi Kishar Kol Avodim Kosher Haya. He was an unusual person, which would suggest on its own that some of this had to do with whether Avodim were deserving of a certain kind of kavod. Okay, but he said to them, my Eved Tevi was different. Okay, so now the Gemara goes back to really the first of the three stories. We're not talking about Rabbi Gamliel anymore, but Chassan. In Rotze Likros Kriyashma Laila Harishon, Kore, even though we said that a Chassan, Rabbi Gamliel, taught his students, and they reminded him, that a Chassan is exempt from reading Kriyashma the first night or until he is Boel B. Larishona. So if he wants to read, he can read. And Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Lo Kol HaRotze Litol Es Hashem Yitol. Rabbi Gamliel, as the Gemara will, notice that if it's his son of Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne, he didn't agree with his father. His father read Kriyat Shema and said, I'm not listening to you guys, even though he taught them that. Here, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, you're not allowed. Why are you not allowed to? So the Gemara is going to frame this in the context of what we call Mechse Kiyuhara. It appears to be Gaiva. In other words, Chazal assume that almost normal people cannot have the focus, for the proper focus for Kriya Shema. They cannot have that focus, Laila Rishon. And therefore, they're exempt. And to do it says, I'm special. I'm different than everybody else. I am the master of Kavana. So that, the Rabbi Shimon Leal says, that looks like you're a Baal Gaiva. We have such a thing. It's called Mechsi Kiyora. It looks like a Baal Gaiva. So he says you're not allowed. Now, the Rambam actually quotes this in. He paskins, like Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel, as I believe does the Rif. But others say, Tosfos says, I think the Ravid may say, that was true maybe once upon a time. But today, to not read Kriya Shema Laila Rishona, because you claim your Torah tiered to the mitzvah, and you normally have such kavana, and that, but now I can't have kavana, that would be a statement of yuhara. For better and worse, mostly worse, but in this case it's better, I guess. We don't have the kavana most of the time, or much of the time, that we should when we recite Kriya Shema and when we daven as well. And therefore, for us, we would say that a chassan, even Laila Rishona, is mechuyev in the midst of Kriya Shema, because he'll read it like he reads it every other night, half-focused on a good night, so won't be the end of the world. Okay, some Rishonim, I believe the Rush says, we paskin like the Tanakama. In the end, it doesn't matter, because whether or not you want to paskin like the Tanakama, or whether you just want to say, well, we really paskin in principle like Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel, that there's a concern of Yuhara, but not for us, because it goes, because it would actually go the other way, it boils down to the same thing. All right, so now we begin the Gemara. The Gemara says, my time the Rabbi Gamaliel. Why does Rabbi Gamaliel assume that it would be mutter for him to bathe the first night? So the Gemara says, Kosavar aninos lailo de Rabbanon. Dichsiv v'achriso ki yom mar. Rabbi Gamaliel, the Gemara suggests, there is a machlokas in the Seches Zvachim and elsewhere, whether or not, as I mentioned before, the aninos of the night after you bury the mace, is at the reis or not. So the Gemara says that he holds that aninos Laila is only the Rabbanan, and therefore, because it's only the Rabbanan, the Chachamim were not gozer, we would say, we would say that since even when Avelus is the Oraisa, Aninus is the Oraisa, it's only during the day that you bury. So even though in general the Chachamim prohibited Rechitza for everybody, they weren't gozer on an Istinus bathing, once Aninus or once Avelus would only be the Rabbanan. So had it been the Raisa, so they might have prohibited even an Istinus from bathing. Okay. So Tosus just asks a very important question. The Tosus Aninus Laila the Rabbanan, the second Tosus from the bottom, he says, the Imtomar Vare One Nami Eno Noeg Ela B'maisa. Even Aninus mit the Oraisa, the Gemara is talking about is everything depends upon whether an Istinus can bathe, depends upon whether the Aninus is the Oraisa or the Rabbanan. Tosa says, even by an Onin, Anainus is only knowing Elab Amaser. It only applies by Maisa Sheni. He's not talking about Kachem, but that as well. Aval Inyan Rechitza, the Avelus, the Rabbanan, who? All the Rechitzas, the Rabbanan. The Imkein, La Olam Emelacha, Daninus Laila, the Rice, Havag Abemaisa. Why does Rabban Gamaliel have to hold that Aninus Laila, with respect to Maiser, is only the Rabbanan? Even if it were the Raisa, the Issa of Rechitza is not the Raisa. So therefore, Tosa says, why does the Gemara tie this to Aninus Laila, the Rabbanan? And Tosas says, "V'yishlomar din isa dahave doraisa gabe meiser gabe shar dorim the rabbanan nabi haven lan the mixa." If in fact Aninus had been midoraisa at night, then the rabbanan, when they made their gzeira on rechitza, should have treated it like a doraisa. The chod the tikkun rabbanan kein doraisa tikkun. But once you say that even the Aninus of meiser sheni at night is and kachim is only the rabbanan, so then since then for the rabbanan, when the whole thing is only the rabbanan. When the Chachamim goes there, they limited their gzera to people for whom a not bathing would not actually be physical tzar. Okay. Now the Gemara goes to the story of the Avadim. Uch shemes tevi avdo, tan rabbanon. And I warn you, I should probably say, give a trigger warning in advance because the comments of Rabbi Eliezer are something that I think we might find a little bit hard to swallow. So when you have avadim shvachos, meaning Eved Kanani and Shifcha Kananis who die, so you don't stand for them in a shura, meaning the shura we make at the cemetery, and you don't say birchas havelim. They used to make a bracha in the street. We don't do this anymore. If you look at the Gemara Ksuba, Tav Chesam and Beis, you'll see various nuschaos that they used to say. They used to make in public some type of bracha for the Avelim. And Tanchume Avelim, which I assume is regular Nicham Avelim, you don't do that. You don't do that for an Eved or a Shifcha. Now, one might, of course, ask the question, of course you don't do it for an Eved or a Shifcha. They're not related to you. You only do these things for the relatives. And the Avadim Nishvachos, technically speaking, have no Krovim. I'm not going to go into the issue, but it's a Yuchsin question. So the Rishonim point out that if you want to volunteer to engage in Avelos for someone, someone's very close to you, and someone dies, and you want to, in effect, Sitshiva, it's not Asur, provided that you don't violate any Isurim or you don't fail to fulfill mitzvahs, which means you're obligated to wear tefillin even the first day. And if you're, let's say, a man's wife goes to the mikvah, he has an obligation of the mitzvah Ona, he's not exempt from that. So he can keep things that don't run afoul in any way of halachic observance. A person can choose to do that. The place that, by the way, is very, very relevant is for a stepchild. Very often stepchildren will choose to sit shiva for a stepparent, even though, technically speaking, there is no chiv of avelus. And it doesn't mean in that circumstance, even though a child would be allowed to do so and probably encouraged to do so, they should still wear tefillin the first day. And the mitzvah ona probably is not going to be as big of a deal in that context, but at least the mitzvah tefillin is the one place it comes up. They're also chayiv in Talmud Torah, but you can learn things that an avel is permitted to learn anyway. So there is such a thing as volunteering avelos, but as long as you don't fail to fulfill mitzvahs, you're generally obligated in. But that you don't do on an eved or shivcha. Tosis writes on the bottom line, ein om demaleim b'shura, dilma asi la suke b'yosin. People will assume if you engage in shivcha, the eved, in fact, is really, he's a ben chorin, and his children are free people, and they can marry into the kahal, and so on. Okay, here goes. Masa umesa shifchaso sharabi Eliezer. It happened once that Rabbi Eliezer shifcha died. Nichnasu tamidav v'nachamo. His students entered to be menachem. Kevan shira osa, when he saw them coming, ala lalia, he went up to the second floor, to the attic, to get away from them. V'alu acharav, they followed him. Nichnas la'anpilo, he entered some other chamber. Nichnasu acharav. Nechnas l'traklin, he entered some entry hall. He goes to the next room. Nechnasu acharat. Finally, Amar Lahem, he said to them, Kimedumani shatam nichvim b'poshrim. I thought that even with lukewarm water, you get burned. You get the message. But achshav, iyatam nichvim afilu b'chamei chanin. Now, I can put boiling hot water on you, and you still don't get scalded. He kept trying to tell them. Every time he moves to another room, they should figure out, well, maybe he doesn't want us here. He doesn't want us to do something. But no matter what he does, they keep following him. So, lo kach shanisi lachem avadim ushvachos en omnam aleim b'shur v'en omra aleim b'rchas aveilam v'lo tanchu aveilam. Elama omrim aleim, k'shem she'omrim lo la'adam al shorov al chamorov shanesu Hamakum yimalei lecha chesroncha. Kach omrim lo al avada val shivcha. So hamakum yimalei lecha chesroncha. It's a little bit, I find this a little bit hard to swallow. The idea that you're comparing the death of an Ever Shivcha. You know, what he's basically saying is it's just a financial loss. You go to get it, you buy another Ever Shivcha or something like that. It's a little bit hard to swallow. Rabbi Eliezer was a very charif personality. But even Im Kol Zeh, it's a little bit hard. I haven't seen the Rishonim comment on it, but the Gemara is what it is. But I admit not something that leaves me a little bit unsettled reading it. Okay. Tanya Idach, we have another brisa. Avad mushfachos ein maspidin osam. You don't eulogize them. Rabbi Yose Omer, an Eved Kasher who Omer Nalav Hay Ishto Venemon. He was a good person. He was trustworthy. He enjoyed the fruits of hard work. Amrulah, they said to Rabbi Yosef, and came mahi nachta l'ksherim. What did you leave for ksherim? Now, I have to say, reading this Gemara, clearly the practices of Hesed were once upon a time a little different. The Gemara says, I think, that kishem shenifraim in achayim, tach nifraim in amesim. When maspidim get up and they tell lies about the mace, I will try to be very, very unobvious, but there are certain places in which funerals are held, in which you go to the funeral and you witness revisionist history, things that you know were not true about the mace. I sometimes had friends who were sitting shiva, who siblings or other relatives said things about the mace that were completely untrue. So the Gemara says that just as they punish the maspidim for speaking untruth, they punish the mason as well whatever the reason is when untruth is spoken about them. There is a halacha in Shulchan Aruch when you're maspid, you're allowed to be magzim. You can speak in a little bit of guzma, and only a little bit. And the question is, why are you allowed to even speak a little bit of sheker? So I think it's the Taz who says, one of the Achronim says that the reason why you're allowed to speak with a little bit of guzma is because everybody thinks people speak in guzma. So if you tell the exact truth about the mace, everybody is now going to say, okay, well, the mace was that, but minus a little bit. So you're going to end up denigrating the mace from what the mace really deserves, because everybody's going to factor that in. Someone once told me, you know, question whether or not on your shidduch resume, whether you can bump your age down a couple of years, because everybody assumes you're going to do it anyway. So if you don't do it, then they're just going to bump, then they're going to say, oh, they're really 2 years older than that, and that won't be true. I don't think that it's mutter to do that. If that's the situation where you need to find a different shidduch service or a different community, then have to lie. But nonetheless, we understand that in certain social contexts, everybody understands you take certain things with a grain of salt. So you have to be careful in both directions there. So apparently in those days, they only said things that were true about people. So the ksherim, who were Yisraelim, you wouldn't tell them the biggest tzaddikim, and they knew only half a shas bal peh. You didn't say those things about them, and of course they never had internet or television or any things like that, and they never wasted a minute. You don't say those things about everybody. You say that only about people whom it's really true. So for ksherim, then you only say so they said then you can't say the avadim are in the same category. Okay, fine. So the Gemara is actually is finished with that, and so now I'm going to read on just a little bit further. A couple of agados, one which I don't really fully understand. The Rishonim give a number of different interpretations. Tana Rabbanan, in Koran Avos Ela L'Shloshav, in Koran Imos Ela L'Arba. So we only refer to three as Avos. You say Avram Avinu, you say Yitzchak Avinu, you say Yaakov Avinu. You don't say Reuven Avinu, Yehuda Avinu, Binyamin Avinu. And by Imos, you say Sarah Imenu, and Rivka Imenu, and Rachel Imenu, and Leah Imenu. You don't say I don't know who, I'm not sure what would be next, Dina Imenu or Serach Imenu. We don't say that. So the question is, in what context does this really apply? Some Rishonim say it's just an agadic statement. It's not clear how this matters in practical terms, but the Gemara just wants to know why now. That perhaps is the more interesting part. And the Gemara says, my time, Ilem Mishum Zalaya Dinan Ime Ruven Kasinan Ime Shimon Kasinan, you'll say, that you say Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, because we're all descendants of them, but not Reuven, because we may not be from Shevet Reuven, or we may not be from Shevet Shimon. So the Gemara says, Ihachi imahos nami lo yadinon, imi Rachel, imi Leah kasinon, right? Rivka, we can say Sarah imenu and Rivka imenu, but we don't know whether to say Leah imenu, if we're from Shevet Yehuda, or Rachel imenu from Shevet Binyamin. So that's
Rabbi,
the reason why. Yes?
What is the connection here? How did this
How did this Bryce
come
in?
It's for the continuation of the Bryce. You'll see in the second line. Josh, that's an excellent question. Because you're supposed to ask that question, but when the Gemara gets to a companion Brysa, you'll see why in a second. All right? But in the meantime, so just hold off 1 second. So the Gemara says, Ela ad hocha chashibi tfei lo chashibi. Somehow these avos were the most important. Maybe they were of greater stature than any of their children, and the most, which is true for the same thing, and that's why we don't give the same title to Reuven or Shimon or Levi or Yehuda, etc. Okay, Tanya Idach, and here it is, Josh, we have another Brysa. Avadim ushvachos in koronoso abaploni ve'ima plonis. You don't give him those titles. So Rashi says the way we would call someone Mr. Marploni and Mars plonis, they would call people as a sign of respect abaplonis and ima plonis. You don't give avadim that title. And again, the issue here might be people will assume that they are b'nei chorin, and for the purposes of yuchsin, the purpose of the marriage, they're free people. But the sherabban gamliel hayu koronoso Abba Ploni v'ima Plonis. They would be given that title. So the Gemara says, Masa l'star. You just quote halacha and then you tell a story that's the exact opposite. So the Gemara says, no, mishum d'chashive. So some Rishonim say, because everybody understood that their titles were not because they were, you know, b'nei chorin, but it's because they were distinguished personalities in the house of the Nasi. So that's why, Josh, because in Karan la'avos el shlosha, in Karan Abba Ploni or ima Plonis, so that's why they put that first agada here. Okay, so that's what the Gemara has to say about this issue of avadim. I'm not going, you know, again, there is certainly something to chew over about the statement earlier, which I find to be unsettling. There's a lot more in Hilchos Avadim to talk about, which we're not going to talk about because we're doing Maseches Brachos. So we'll stop here, and next week we will begin. I just want to give you the upcoming attractions, which is that the Gemara is going to list a series of tfilos here, of Yehi Ratzons and things like that, that Amoraim used to say after they finished their Shemona Esrei, some of which you will recognize, from various kinds of liturgical contexts, some of which you won't, but basically it's going to go through almost the rest of the Perek, the Sagada, and we will begin with that next week.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Was there any, I don't know if this is in the Rishonim or anywhere in the Achronim, the business of Tava Bayam, the Sfina, is there anyone who says, no, that's, you can really be tarud there. You know, you might be tarud, so then you'd be putter, because, you know, that's a life-threatening situation.
Well, if you are, Tava Sfina Savayam doesn't mean he's on the boat. It means your stuff is on the boat.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm sorry, I should have made that clear. You're on the sea and you're watching your boat with all your merchandise, you know, about to sink into the, you know, into the water. No, it's not you. It's not Bikoch Nevesh. If your life is in danger, presumably you're putter from Kirshma because you should be attempting to lower the lifeboat or get the life jacket and be swimming. No, it means it's just your property.
All right. Thank you. Okay.